The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Britain is declining. Its allies are distant. Across the channel, Europe is in crisis. Nations are making dangerous alliances and arming themselves. The global economy is wobbling. Britain's armed forces are thin and weak. The nation itself is wallowing in an identity crisis. We're not talking about 2015, although we could be. We're talking about 1933 and the dirge that preceded World War II. World War II threatened Western civilization, but during the 1930s, Britain itself threatened Western civilization. That is to say, Britain's weakness and Britain's degeneracy threatened the very civilization it had built. Here's just one example of how the British leadership was thinking. It's the infamous Oxford Union debate from 82 years ago, February 9th. A motion was offered, something these students wish to proclaim and publish and record in history. So let us look at that history. In that debate, one side disputed that the only country fighting for the cause of peace was Soviet Russia. That side argued in favor of this resolution. This house will in no circumstances fight for its king and country. The motion passed, and it surprised Britain and the world. But it was a symptom of something deeper and much more widespread. Germany and Europe and the world took note. Britain was weary of war. Britain was tired of fighting. Britain disdained its greatness. Oxford was full of this sentiment. So was London. So was Whitehall. To the point that Britain humored and compromised with one of the most brutal regimes in human history. And in spite of all that compromising and deference, that regime bombed London. But there was another voice in England. It wasn't coming from Westminster. It wasn't coming from high office. It was coming out of the political wilderness. That voice died in January 1965, 50 years ago, and it belonged to a man named Winston Spencer Churchill. Like many others across the United Kingdom and around the world in recent weeks, today we honor the memory of Sir Winston Churchill. We remember the time in which he lived. We remember the peril his nation faced. And we remember his miraculous effort to save Britain. Exactly 50 years ago, that honor was even greater and even grander at his state funeral. Winston Churchill was 90 years old when he died on January 24th, 1965. His state funeral was at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. It was attended by one of the largest ever groups of prime ministers and presidents and other statesmen. Her Majesty, the Queen, attended and paid her respects. The world honored this man, especially London. It's estimated that 350 million people in Europe watched his funeral on television. There was a Royal Artillery salute. There was an RAF flyby that was particularly fitting. RAF fighter pilots flying over Winston Churchill in London. When the coffin traveled up the River Thames, the cranes dipped in salute. the funeral train steamed out of London, and there were thousands of people at the stations and even in the fields lining up to watch this man's final journey and to honor him. In fact, the locomotive of that train was even named after him. He held the most noble order of the Garter, the Order of Merit, the Territorial Decoration. He had dozens of other honorary titles and degrees and awards from a dozen countries. He was, of course, a knight. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was the first honorary United States citizen. And today there's an American warship patrolling the seas named the Winston S. Churchill. And of course, his name is inscribed in thousands of places, most notably in Westminster Abbey. Who was this man? He's the most famous and revered prime minister in Britain's long history. He was a man who rallied his nation to stand against Nazi Germany.
You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs.
He was the epitome of Britishness. Winston Churchill was a correspondent and a soldier and an officer. He was a historian and an author, a painter. He was a member of parliament. He was a senior cabinet minister. And he was a prime minister right when Britain needed him the most. Over 90 years of life, Sir Winston Churchill stacked up a huge body of work, and many people might deride him for this or that policy, even today, in the anniversary of his death. People will make accusations, you're just lionizing him. But let's call a lion a lion. No one is arguing that this man was perfect, but there can be no argument over the fact that he was important. Without him, this country, the United Kingdom, would be 75 years into subjugation. So would the United States and France and many other countries. The world would have already fallen over the brink. Now, what was it Winston Churchill fought to defend? Why did he fight the Battle of Britain? Why did he fight in Bangalore and Sudan and South Africa? What was it that drove him? What was it that he was so excited about? Well, it's exactly the thing that Britons today are very much not excited about. The British Empire. Let me refer you to a quote. This is from a book titled Churchill and His Generals by Raymond Callahan. It says, Churchill's hostility toward Bolshevism abroad and socialism at home had its parallel in his reaction to nationalism in the empire. He had grown up with the late Victorian surge of empire building. He was 8 when Britain occupied Egypt, 11 when Gordon fell at Khartoum, and present when Gordon was avenged at Omdurman in 1898. The empire he had known as a young man always would seem to him part of the natural order of things. Churchill passionately loved the British Empire more than anything else in his life. He wanted the empire to be part of the natural order of things. Just one final quote here from this man's book. It was beneficent and an indispensable prop of British power and greatness, yet his entire political career would be played out in an era of challenge and disillusion for imperial rule. Every minute of Churchill's life, every decision and tactic, every new bill, every column and book stemmed from his devotion to the British Empire. It's easy to oversimplify Winston Churchill's love of the empire. He didn't love it simply because it was English or powerful and wealthy or because it ruled over tens of millions of people. Churchill's writings show that his love for empire went much deeper than that. Mr. Churchill's life, his writings, his funeral itself, all pointed to empire. Winston Churchill wanted to share the British Empire with the rest of mankind. It wasn't a perfect empire by any means, but as far as empires go, it was the greatest this world has ever seen. This is the empire that spread around the world, that won the allegiance of 1 in 5 human beings on Earth, that covered a quarter of the Earth's land surface and probably half of its most desirable land surface. This is the empire that did most of its conquering through trade. There were wars, true. There were deaths and injustices, that's true. But what else was there? There was freedom. Freedom to continue local traditions and beliefs. But now the British did interfere with some customs. They outlawed them, in fact. And what kind of customs were these? Infanticide, for one, killing infants, burning widows alive or burying them alive, mutilation, cannibalism. Yes, the British interfered with those kinds of things. They prosecuted people who did those things. Even if the local religion sanctioned robbing and murdering travelers, British law stepped in. Does that sound like oppression? Britain is the power that outlawed slave trade. Britain is the power that outlawed slavery itself. British sailors were the ones who intercepted slave ships. Notice what one English poet wrote to advocate for abolishing slavery. He said, "Slaves cannot breathe in England. If their lungs receive our air, that moment they are free. They touch our country and their shackles fall." Britain spread the English language. It encouraged trade and development. It championed science. It revolutionized industry. It boosted food production. It built extensive roads in countries that had no decent roads. It built railroads across lands that had zero railroads. It constructed dams and reservoirs. It irrigated. It ran telegraph cables. It built bridges and ports and iron-hulled ships and steam engines. It established regular air service, and it spread common law and parliamentary democracy. It opened up freer markets. It gave people the knowledge that they had a right to self-governance and liberty, so that even when it lost its empire, it was perhaps the most peaceful dissolution ever. You can still see it. Go to the tip of Africa, or the schools of India, or the islands of the South Atlantic. There exists a debate over the influence of Great Britain, for sure. There are many sophisticated hatreds of the British Empire. There are many intelligent criticisms, and a number of those criticisms are absolutely true. But stack it up against Greece, or Persia, or Rome. Compare it to the Ottomans, the Spanish, the Germans, the Russians. Compare it to the Italians or the Mongols or the Caliphate. Compare it to the Holy Roman Empire. Whether it was with a pistol or a pen or a microphone, this is what Sir Winston Churchill defended to his death. He saw something that on the whole improved people's lives. We'll be right back.
Why did Great Britain have such a positive influence on the world? Was it because Britain was just better? Were the British inherently more powerful and more equitable? Great Britain spread not only its language, but advancements in agriculture, industry, science, commerce, banking, infrastructure, education, and the list goes on. Entire nations, great nations, have their common law and their representative governments because of the influence of Great Britain. The empire served its own interests, to be sure, but it also advanced its beliefs. It spent much of its treasure, its sailors, its soldiers, and its lives to fight slavery and to rid the world of barbarous practices. Not always because it was economical, but because it was right. Where did those beliefs come from? What were those laws based on? Some may argue that they're just common sense. Some may say that the British are, or were, inherently a better people. Britain's laws were better. Its virtues were better. But not because its people were naturally better. it's because of what Britain's laws were based on. British law traces back beyond the Empire. It traces back beyond England, Scotland, Wales, or Ireland. It traces back through Britain's earliest ancestors. This heritage reaches back not hundreds of years, but thousands of years. It links directly back to a surprising yet familiar source. The virtues and laws of Great Britain don't trace back to a few philosophers and theorists scattered across the past few centuries. They aren't the result of impersonal forces and random historical texts. They trace back to one source. That source was an absolutely perfect law and government. And through the centuries and the millennia, the tighter Britain has clung to that source, the better its laws have been. Understanding that source explains where and why our British ancestors succeeded and where and why they failed. And more to the point, it explains what we today so sorely lack. To find out where British culture originated, read Britain's 4,000-year-old history. This book is adapted from The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. That book was read by 6 million people around the world, far more than a Times bestseller. Request Britain's 4,000-year-old history and prove the identity and future of Britain for yourself.
A strong case can be made for the influence of the Bible on British history. You see it in the judiciary, you see it in Hobbes, you see it in Locke, you see it in the sovereign, you see it in Parliament. This book, the Bible, influenced British history for centuries, and this book claims to contain prophecy. That means forecasts about the future that regard specific nations at specific times. And I submit to you that one of those prophecies is actually about Winston Churchill. Let's begin today in Ezekiel 33. As I said to you last time, go and get your Bible and make sure that you read along with me. Now, as ridiculous as it might sound to you to say that there's a Bible prophecy about Churchill, it's important for you to look at history like we've talked about here today, to look at what the Bible has to say about our time, and even recent history. If you look back at Britain's history with respect to World War II, for instance, it wasn't that long ago when most people in Britain just concluded that what happened at places like Dunkirk during World War II, that it was a miracle from God. From God. In Winston Churchill's own words, he said 335,000 British troops were delivered out of the jaws of death and shame. Think about the Battle of Britain and how Hitler boasted that he'd erase British cities. More than 1,000 German bombers and fighters pounded London during one night alone. The Royal Air Force was outnumbered by more than 2-1, and yet they shot down more German planes. Remember the miracle of D-Day? And how at the last possible moment, during the windiest month in Normandy for 20 years, a break in the weather occurred that allowed the Allies to launch the invasion of Europe. And at the same time, because of the predicted stormy weather on D-Day, the Germans were caught off guard. These were miracles from God. And as I say, not that long ago, many people in Britain believed that. They believed that God intervened. Why would God do something like that? Why did he intervene for Britain? Well, let's look now at Ezekiel 33, and we'll start in verse 1, where it says, "Again, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of your people, and say unto them, When I bring the sword upon a land, if the people of the land take a man of their coasts and set him for their watchman, if when he sees the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people." Now, Ezekiel's message is addressed to Israel. Israel's mentioned 186 times throughout the book. I'll leave it to you to study into this further. We can't obviously cover all the material. But what's important for you to know is that when Ezekiel recorded his message, Israel Israel and Judah, remember, had divided many years before during the days of Rehoboam. Israel had been in captivity for over 100 years. And yet here is this prophet in captivity in Babylon writing to Israel that had gone into captivity in Assyria a century earlier, warning Israel. Warning Israel. This is showing that it's primarily the descendants of Israel, latter-day Israelites, that Ezekiel's message pertains to, these prophecies of God. You can hold your place there in Ezekiel 33 and switch over to Matthew chapter 10. This is where Christ is giving his disciples their commission to reach out to the lost tribes of Israel, the lost sheep, as he calls them here. This is Matthew 10. And we'll start in verse 5, where it says, these 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter you not, verse 6 says, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Go to the lost sheep. Now, this is why when you get into the history of the first century church in the book of Acts, that after Acts chapter 11, you don't see much more from the original 12 apostles. You don't see anything more to speak of except for the conference there in Acts 15. But for the most part, the rest of the history there covered is about the apostle Paul and the work that went to the Gentile region. The other apostles went to the lost sheep. They were lost. They lost their identity when they went into captivity, but they still existed. They were still a people. And what Christ says in Matthew 10 there proves that. That's why he said, go to the lost sheep. They were lost, but they remained a people. And eventually they became free, and they multiplied, and they grew in power. And if you track their history, you can see that it matches up exactly with what God had promised to the great patriarch, Abraham. The Bible talks about Abraham's descendants becoming a great nation, a great single nation, a great superpower nation, and also a great company of nations. A great company of nations. Now back to Ezekiel chapter 33, and let's just pick it up again with verse 1. But if you think about the work that we've proclaimed, the message that this church has proclaimed for many decades, I mean, do you know of a powerful, wealthy, numerous company of nations whose history is associated with Bible prophecy? Well, of course you do, if you've read our literature, if you've read the United States and Britain in prophecy in particular. You know God has a lot to say about our peoples. He has a lot to say about the people of Britain and the British Empire or the former empire. He has a lot to say about the people of the United States of America as well. Well, back to this prophecy here. 75 years ago, God brought a sword upon our peoples, and he then raised up a man who came on the scene, who saw the sword, who warned our people when everyone else was pretty much mocking him, ridiculing him. Back to Ezekiel 33, verse 1 again says, again, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, son of man, speak to the children of your people, and say unto them, when I bring the sword upon a land, if the people of the land take a man of their coast and set him for their watchman, if, it says, when he sees the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people. See, the people, as it says here in these first few verses, they set him up as their watchman. Churchill saw the sword when nobody else did. So they certainly didn't see him in America, or at least America wasn't really ready to face what was happening in Europe. They were isolationist. They wouldn't admit that Hitler was actually out to conquer the world. That was his aim. That was his ambition. And a lot of people in America refused to believe that. Britain's parliament, they ran from the truth. Look at the Western media. Look at how angry Mr. Churchill was with the media, or that motion that was passed at Oxford, as I said there at the top of the program. That was the general sentiment Everyone refused to face reality. Everyone except Winston Churchill. Now that's recent history. That's just, as I said at the top, 50 years ago that he died. 75 years ago when he came on the scene. And when he warned the world that Hitler was on a rampage and that Hitler was out to conquer the world. Verse 3 again, it says, if when he sees the sword come upon the land, he blows the trumpet and warn the people. He warned, and he single-handedly turned things around. Let me refer you to his own statement. This is from Churchill himself, who said, I was conscious of a profound sense of relief. At last, I had the authority. This is when he came into power now. At last, I had the authority to give directions to the whole scene. I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past had been but a preparation for this hour in this trial. He felt like he was walking with destiny, and he was. He was, and then you put all these other events together with it. Like I said, Dunkirk or D-Day or the Battle of Britain. God's hand was present. That man was walking with destiny. He was, you could say, a political watchman. Now the rest of chapter 33 talks about a watchman not set up by the people, but one that God appoints in these latter days, bringing it right up to speed with where we are today. You need to go on and study that for yourself later. I don't have time to get into it today. But coming back to these first few verses in Ezekiel 33, it's incredible, really, to think that this history shows up thousands of years ago in the Bible. It's incredible to think that the leader the people set before World War II was actually a man that God had specially prepared. Even Mr. Churchill recognized that, as you can see from that quote. He saw the sword and he warned. That was prophecy before he came along, and now it's history. And the critical question for you and for me and for all of us is, have we learned this critical lesson from recent history? That's all we have time for today. We thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.